Imagine you're in this intense life-or-death battle. You pull out your sword, and you're mentally prepared to face some terrifying, scaly monster.
Right, you're bracing for impact.
Exactly. You brace yourself, but instead, a fluffy pink bunny hops out of the underbrush.
Which is just, I mean, it's absurd.
Yeah, you probably laugh, right? The tension just totally evaporates. But then the creature's head snaps backward at this completely unnatural angle.
It's so gross.
It really is. It begins foaming blood from its neck. And suddenly you realize you have absolutely no idea what rules govern the universe you're standing in.
That is the exact moment the genre of the story just fractures in real time. It's the ultimate narrative bait and switch.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're immersing ourselves in a really fascinating artifact of collaborative digital storytelling.
We really are.
We're pulling apart a set of highly detailed text-based role-playing game logs dating all the way back to late 2008.
Yeah, they're quite old, but so incredibly detailed.
And our mission for you today is to unpack how this specific narrative seamlessly weaves together, you know, bizarre humor, genuinely gruesome threats, and deep character psychology into a single cohesive experience.
It's honestly brilliant.
For anyone interested in how stories are constructed or how tension is built, manipulated, and released, this is an absolute masterclass.
What makes these logs so compelling is the pacing. I mean, we're tracking an adventuring party through a sequence that begins with utter absurdity, transitions into, like, profound quiet, and then weaponizes that quiet in a targeted psychological attack.
Let's start with that absurdity. So the party is traveling through a forest when they get ambushed by what the logs describe as a troll rabbit.
A troll rabbit.
Yeah, which sounds like a total joke. And initially, you know, it plays out like one. You have this big, fluffy, pink bunny chasing one of the party members.
Oh, the eccentric doglin, Rosie.
Exactly, Rosie. And she is, like, easily distracted, but right now she is wailing, just running for her life.
But the humor dies instantly when the physical mechanics of the fight are revealed.
It really does. Because this rabbit is a nightmare.
It is. The physical force the party throws at this creature is immense, and it's completely ineffective. I mean, they have two heavy night steeds with them.
Oh, right. The horses.
Yeah. The horse named Suhait literally tramples the creature, just running right over it with a series of sickening crunches. And then the other horse, Princess Peach Blossom, stomps its skull with a delicate hoof, which results in this horrible crack and squish.
But the thing just refuses to die.
Exactly.
It's reduced to this mutilated blob of pink fur, but it writhes and contorts, and it's instantly regrowing its severed limbs.
And reforming its crushed head. It's just awful.
Yeah. And then an older fairy minstrel in the party named Sam, he winds up and smashes it over the head with his lute.
Which is such a funny mental image.
The logs literally spell out the sound. It just says B-W-O-O.
Right, but the rabbit just rotates its eyes independently and keeps attacking them.
Which is terrifying. Finally, a proper fey knight named Tristan has to abandon his honorable sword and pull out a literal medieval flamethrower.
Yeah, because nothing else works. And the destruction of the creature is incredibly visceral.
Oh, yeah.
The stench of the burning, bubbling troll flesh is so horrific that the party is forced to dig a fire pit just to incinerate the remains completely.
They had to stir the ashes, right?
Yeah, they stir the ashes just to make absolutely sure nothing regenerates.
Okay, so let's unpack this monster design for a second. It's almost like a corrupted cartoon character.
That's a great way to put it.
Like if Bugs Bunny were suddenly directed by a horror filmmaker.
Yeah.
But I have to ask, you know, why use such a ridiculous enemy?
Wow.
Like, if the game master wanted to threaten the party, why not just use a traditional dragon or a swarm of goblins? Does the sheer absurdity actually make the threat more terrifying?
What's fascinating here is that it absolutely does.
Yeah.
And it really comes down to exploiting the player's cognitive load.
Cognitive load, okay.
Yeah. Think about it. When a party fights a dragon, their brains rely on established schemas.
Right.
They know dragons breathe fire. They know they have scales. They know they need a certain type of weapon to pierce that armor.
They have a mental playbook to fall back on.
Precisely. They are mentally prepared for a high-stakes encounter governed by traditional fantasy logic.
Right. But with a regenerating pink bunny.
Exactly. When they're fighting a bubbling, regenerating pink bunny whose limbs are snapping back into place, the brain has no schema to fall back on.
Wow. Yeah.
It induces genuine panic. The game master is forcing the characters and the players controlling them to realize that their conventional logic simply doesn't apply here. It completely removes the safety net of predictability.
Which strips away their illusion of mastery. I mean, you can't outthink an opponent if you don't even know what physical laws govern its existence.
Exactly.
It forces a character like Tristan, who clearly values chivalry and form, to drop his elegant sword for a crude, messy flamethrower just to survive.
And taking that step further, consider the lingering effect of an encounter like that.
Yeah.
The victory doesn't feel triumphant. It just feels gross.
Yeah. They're not celebrating.
Not at all. The characters are left exhausted, nauseous, and physically covered in sticky, foul-smelling troll blood.
And this brings us to a really fascinating principle of game design and storytelling, which is weaponizing safety.
Yes.
Because they are covered in this horrific mess, they're desperate for a place to clean up. I mean, they can't just keep walking down the path like that.
Right, they need a break.
This desperate physical need forces them to seek out a sanctuary, which leads them directly to one of the strangest, most atmospheric locations in the entire forest.
They step off the trail and arrive at this glowing grove lit by thousands of fireflies. It features a steaming pool and a giant old tree.
It sounds beautiful.
It is. This is the sacred shrine of sarsaparilla.
The environmental design here is just incredible. The shrine features these ancient stone altars with taps that, when you turn them, pour out foamy, caramel-colored root beer instead of water.
Which is such a wild detail.
Totally. And Rosie the Doglin casually provides this completely bizarre local lore about it.
Right.
She notes that they are perfectly safe to camp in the grove, because the treacherous dire pigs of the forest still fear the shrine.
Now, why do they fear it?
Because of the famous rib cookout massacre.
It's a brilliant, subtle twist on the three little pigs, woven naturally into the mythology of this specific world.
It really keeps the fantasy setting feeling vibrant and, well, deeply weird.
Very weird.
But amidst this surreal root beer flowing backdrop, the story shifts entirely into deep, intimate character building.
It does. Sam the minstrel is casually cooking root beer chili shish kebabs over an offering bowl.
As you do.
Right. Meanwhile, Tristan, our proper knight, becomes comically flustered because another party member, a runaway fae maiden named Hannah, is taking a bath in the pool.
And they set up this amazing modesty wall.
Yes. To protect her privacy, the two horses, Sohei and Peach Blossom, have formed a literal modesty wall.
I love that the horses have personality.
Oh, they are actively teasing Tristan by blocking his view. And Hannah, seeing how awkward and strictly chivalrous he's being, playfully pulls him fully clothed into the pool for a kiss. Yeah, it's a moment of complete vulnerability. Hannah uses the opportunity to apologize for past misunderstandings between them, and Tristan offers her complete forgiveness and acceptance.
Okay, but here's where I really have to push back on the structure of this narrative.
Okay, let's hear it.
We just went from a body horror survival scene with a bloody, regenerating troll rabbit straight into a rom-com set in a root beer spa.
It is a big shift.
The tonal whiplash is massive. Doesn't this completely derail the tension they just spent an hour building?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it might look like a detour on the surface, but structurally, it's the exact opposite.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Storytellers refer to this as the pacing calculus.
Pacing calculus.
Right. You cannot sustain high stakes, life or death tension indefinitely. The audience's adrenal system will simply burn out and the threats will become monotonous.
I see.
This downtime is what we call the campfire phase, and it serves a critical function called emotional anchoring.
Meaning the calm actually creates the stakes for the next storm.
Yes, exactly. The romance and the quiet conversation aren't just a break from the plot. They are structural, load-bearing storytelling.
Wow, load-bearing storytelling. I like that.
By giving the characters a moment of complete comfort and mutual acceptance, the game master is resetting their baseline. They're reminding the players what these characters have to lose. It anchors their humanity.
And crucially, the narrative doesn't actually stall during this campfire phase.
Oh, no, it doesn't.
While Tristan and Hannah are having this profound moment in the pool, Rosie the Doglin is poking around the shoreline and discovers an abandoned leather pack.
Right, the pack.
It belongs to a missing character named Prince Feasel. And inside, she finds backwards written notes and a map heavily pointing toward a Band of Queens cave hidden deep off the path.
That map is an essential narrative breadcrumb. It ensures that the plot's momentum is maintained even while the characters are resting. And because the players have just experienced this profound safety and connection, they're naturally emboldened. They choose to follow the map.
Which is exactly how the Game Master leverages their newly restored confidence against them.
Oh, totally.
Because the moment they step off the main path, following Feasel's map, Rosie warns them that this is where the forest tricks you.
And she wasn't kidding.
No. The environment immediately turns hostile, blinding Tristan with forest delusions, so disorienting that he repeatedly walks face first into trees.
They're systematically being stripped of the control they just regained at the shrine.
It's brutal.
When they finally reach the destination, which is a cave mouth shaped like stalagmite teeth, they attempt to enter carefully and tactically.
Of course they do.
But the Game Master immediately punishes that caution. The floor of the cave literally drops out from under them, swallowing the entire party into a stone slide.
They get dumped into this dark room where a disembodied voice begins taunting them with unsettling poetry.
Oh, the poetry.
It says, "Two little hawks walked into my house."
So creepy.
Yeah. So Hey the Horse manages to kick open a hidden passage, leading them into a circular room with 10 closed archways. And the moment they step inside, doors slam down, sealing the exits.
This is where the physical exhaustion begins. The circular room starts spinning.
Wait, like a centrifuge?
Exactly. Rusty, grinding blades slide out of the walls, showering the stone in sparks. The centripetal force constantly pushes them outward toward the blades.
That's terrifying.
It is. It forces Tristan to frantically use rope to anchor everyone to the heavy mass of the horses in the center of the room.
When the room finally grinds to a halt and the doors raise back up, the party is just left dizzy, bruised, and nauseous.
Completely drained.
And they're facing those 10 identical archways. So to figure out which way to go without stepping blindly into a trap, Hannah whistles down the dark corridors.
And the responses they receive from the dark are a masterclass in sensory overload.
Oh, yeah. One corridor growls so loudly the stone floor vibrates.
Another echoes with high-pitched cackling and fingernails scraping on slate. Others emit the squishing sounds of a slimy mass, the roar of a horrific bonfire, and the rhythmic sound of heavy meat being chopped into little pieces.
After hearing this terrifying menu of options, the party confidently chooses door number one anyway.
Naturally.
I look at this sequence, and it just feels like a sadistic escape room where every clue is a direct threat.
Yeah, pretty much.
So why give players a choice if literally all the options sound like terrible ways to die? What's the architectural purpose of designing a trap this way?
This raises an important question, and the architectural purpose is to weaponize the illusion of choice.
The illusion of choice.
Right. When players enter a dungeon, they expect their decisions to matter. They expect that if they are clever enough, if they test the doors and listen carefully, they can deduce the correct path.
They believe their intellect can save them.
But the unseen Game Master, whether that's the Bandit Queen or the architecture of the cave itself, is methodically breaking down that belief. First, the spinning blade room attacked their physical defenses and balance. Then the 10 doors attack their mental defenses by overloading their working memory with pure terror.
Right, because every option is horrible.
Exactly. By presenting 10 equally horrific choices, the Game Master induces decision fatigue. The players realize their careful planning is useless. It's a psychological manipulation designed to make them feel entirely vulnerable and completely stripped of their agency.
That makes perfect sense. The systematic exhaustion of their physical and logical defenses leaves the party entirely unprotected.
Completely.
Because the moment they walk down the corridor of door number one, the dungeon suddenly shifts tactics. It abandons rusty blades and physical traps for something far more insidious.
They don't find a growling monster behind the door. They find a room where the floor drops away into a massive, seemingly bottomless pit.
Right, but then Hannah accidentally falls forward and discovers that it isn't an open pit at all.
No.
It's a floor made of incredibly thick, perfectly clean glass.
Yeah.
It just looks like a bottomless void.
So tricky.
So carefully, the party crosses the glass and sits down to catch their breath. But the trap is just resetting.
The disembodied voice returns, whispering, "I like old meat."
Which is so gross.
The lights cut out. A violent wind whips up inside the confined space, and in the pitch-black, unseen hands grab the characters and violently rip the party apart.
When the darkness lifts, the physical danger has vanished entirely. Hannah wakes up to find Tristan and Sam gone.
She's isolated.
Yeah, she's alone with Rosie the Doglin in an environment constructed completely of mirrors.
And this is where the mechanics of the game merge perfectly with the character's internal psychology.
Exactly. Earlier in the adventure, Tristan had suggested that Hannah could stack two magic monocles she carried to see through illusions.
Right.
So trapped in this maze, Hannah stacks the monocles and looks into the mirror. It's almost like putting on a pair of 3D glasses that force you to look at your own deepest insecurities.
That's a great analogy. The monocles act like a narrative decryption key. They bypass the physical illusion of the glass maze, but instead of showing her the stone walls of the cave, they force the software of her own mind to render her deepest fears as reality.
And the image she sees is devastating.
It really is. The monocles reveal that she has been physically reverted to her younger self.
Oh, wow.
She's wearing the restrictive, courtly dress her father forced her to wear, the exact dress she was wearing when she originally ran away from home. Furthermore, Rosie the dog then has been reduced to a small, helpless terrier.
She's been stripped of her weapons, her adventuring experience, and her allies.
Yes.
She's forced to navigate a shifting, disorienting illusion of a forest. And she quickly realizes she's being hunted.
But the monster hunting her isn't a troll rabbit. It's an illusion of Tristan.
Which is so much worse.
It is. This fake Tristan steps out of the shadows and he doesn't attack her with a weapon. He speaks to her with cold politeness, saying, "Your father will be displeased with your actions, m'lady. Now it is time to come home."
I see the psychological angle here, but I have to question the escalation from a game design perspective.
Oh.
Like, wait, so the trap stops trying to slice them up with rusty blades and just sends Hannah to forced exposure therapy.
Basically, yes.
If you take away player agency and just force them to look in a mirror at their own backstory, don't you risk them feeling railroaded? How is a fake, polite Tristan a bigger threat than a bottomless pit?
Well, it feels like railroading only if the psychological attack doesn't connect to a choice the player has already made.
Okay.
A physical trap can only harm the avatar's body. A psychological trap attacks the character's core motivation.
Right.
You have to look at Hannah's foundational identity. Her entire existence as an adventurer is predicated on escaping her father's strict, suffocating control. That is why she is in this forest to begin with.
Oh, I see.
The maze weaponizes that foundation. It attempts to convince her that the person she trusts most in the world, Tristan, is actually an agent of the very oppression she fled.
It's trying to break her spirit by isolating her from the one connection that makes her feel safe.
Yes. But here is the brilliant payoff of the entire session. The trap fails.
Nice.
And it fails precisely because of the pacing calculus we discussed earlier.
Oh, the campfire phase.
Exactly. Hannah sees through the illusion immediately. She calmly notes that the real Tristan would never turn her over to her father because he accepts her exactly as she is.
Because he proved it at the root beer shrine.
Exactly. The emotional clarity and mutual acceptance she gained in that quiet romantic downtime is the specific armor that allows her to defeat the psychological torture of the maze. The trap tested a bond that was forged during the campfire phase.
This serves as such a powerful reminder for you as a listener, navigating your own complex environments.
It really does.
Often, our biggest obstacles aren't the external spinning blades or the loud, growling monsters of daily stress. The hardest battles are the internal narratives, the past baggage, and the self-doubt we are forced to confront when the lights go out.
We spend so much time armoring ourselves for the physical and logistical challenges of the world, but we often leave our psychological flanks completely exposed.
Wow, yeah.
Hannah survived because she had recently fortified her internal world.
To distill the journey of this deep dive, we've tracked how a collaborative digital story can begin with a cognitively overloaded fight against a flaming troll rabbit, detour into a romantic root beer-scented sanctuary, and culminate in a profound psychological mirror maze.
Quite the journey.
It perfectly illustrates how action, world-building lore, and character development aren't separate sequential elements of a story. They are a continuous feedback loop.
You cannot have the emotional payoff of the mirror maze without the absolute physical exhaustion of the spinning cave or the deep vulnerability established at the campfire. They are gears in the exact same machine.
Taking that a step further, I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder that builds on the architecture of this entire sequence.
Let's hear it.
What if the characters had simply pushed through the forest, entirely skipping the downtime at the Shrine of Sarsaparilla?
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
Right. If Hannah and Tristan hadn't solidified their bond, if they hadn't found that mutual acceptance in a quiet, seemingly disconnected moment, would Hannah have had the emotional armor required to see through the illusion of Tristan in the maze?
The mechanics of the trap suggest she likely would have broken under the weight of her own past.
It really makes you wonder, how often are the quiet, seemingly unimportant moments of connection in our own lives actually the very armor we are unknowingly forging for our biggest battles.
That's a beautiful point.
Sometimes the environment shifts around you not to trick you, but to test the strength of the foundation you built when you thought no one was attacking.
A brilliant way to view the architecture of our own lives.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Keep looking beyond the mirrors, and we'll catch you next time.